You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with Professor Tom Hastings about the interconnections between war and the destruction of the environment, and the converse connections between protecting and caring for our beloved Earth and working for peace.
Not only is the United States military the largest consumer of fossil fuels on Earth, but is the largest polluter in the United States. Part of the historical problem has been that the Pentagon has been exempt from environmental laws. And every time there is some effort at reform, the effort gets rolled back by successive administrations.
This is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Kwe Agwanu, hello and welcome. I'm coming to you from my home in the Dawnland in extremely cold Bunawabskeag territory. We're far beyond chilly here in central Maine. We've been having temperatures well below zero, and we are located in and along the shores of the beautiful Penobscot River. I'm joined today, as always, by my radiant co-host, Miss Rivera Sun. Hi, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. It's a bright, sunny, desert sort of winter day where it's cold and there's snow on the mountains, but the sun is shining. And if you live in an earthship like me, it's really quite lovely because all of those south-facing windows that run the whole length of the house are conveniently heating your house for you, so you don't have to use fossil fuels, you don't even have to burn firewood, you don't even have to have those photovoltaic solar panels. The heat and the light just comes right in the windows. It's pretty amazing architecture. Today, we're going to talk with Tom Hastings, who is actually partly responsible for bringing Sherry and I together in the world. And he is the director of Peace Voice, which is a publications program that puts out op-eds and news about peace and related nonviolence subjects to small and mid-sized journals across the country. He's also a professor of peace and conflict studies at Portland State University, where it would be a great treat to get to be his student. And he's also the author of several books, including a book that I have on my bookshelf called A New Era of Nonviolence. So Tom's going to join us today to talk about the military and the environment and the interconnections between those two issues. As you can imagine, both Sherry and I are looking forward to this conversation very much. Tom, welcome to today's show.
Well, thank you very much, Rivera and Sherry.
Well, Tom, this is a really interesting subject and something that I'm sure there are people who have not put together. So when we start thinking about the connections between the environment and the military, and you start digging a little bit deeper, it's easy to see the correlation and to recognize that the military is probably the single largest polluter on the planet. So why don't you start us off by giving us a brief overview of this connection?
You're absolutely right, Sherry, that not only is the United States military the largest consumer of fossil fuels on Earth, but is the largest polluter in the United States, and pollutes plenty of other places, too. In fact, I'm going to be meeting with some officials from South Korea tomorrow to talk about the United States military base's pollution in their country, which is very significant. Part of the historical problem has been that the Pentagon has been exempt from environmental laws. And every time there is some effort at reform, the effort gets rolled back by successive administrations. So this is a historical problem in the United States in particular. And then when it comes to overseas bases, the problem relates more to the status of forces agreements that the United States negotiates with all of the many countries on which we have military bases. So we've got this huge linking set of problems that in the end result in more Superfund sites from not only the Department of Defense, but the industries that serve them, their contractor industries, so the armaments manufacturers, etc. If you look at the total numbers, it's pretty amazing. Of the 1,200 or so Superfund sites, 900 of them approximately relate either to the Pentagon or to the Pentagon contractors. So this is a horrific legacy in terms of pollution. But then you look at the consumption side of it, and then you see, well, this is a main driver to climate chaos. And when we look at the environmental effects of climate chaos, and you say, well, if the United States alone could begin to solve the problem of war instead of being the lead in waging war, we might see a radical reduction in global warming and climate chaos and all of those negative effects that experts say will lead to approximately at least 150 million climate refugees. Now, if you add the refugees from war to the refugees from climate chaos, and then you look to the roots of both, and you say, this is really stemming from our methods of conflict management. This is the biggest challenge that addresses all of this together. Obviously, there are many more problems, but our methods of managing conflict are the root of most of our environmental problems as well.
That is such an intriguing analysis and point to make, that as a choice, the United States, as an imperialistic nation, I think we can say that fairly accurately in terms of the United States, has chosen to use extreme forms of violence to secure, protect, and dominate its economic and territorial interests throughout the world. And the point that you're making is that this choice also comes hand in hand with environmental devastation. And I appreciate that you brought up the Superfund sites, because currently, when we think of pollution, and this has changed over the years, but currently when we think of environment and pollution, a lot of conscious citizens are thinking about climate change and carbon emissions. But the legacy of war and militarism is deadly and horrifying. I mean, we need only look to Vietnam to remember the effects of DDT and Agent Orange and the defoliation of, I think it was something like 70 or 80% of the entire country, to understand that the toxic legacy of the military is enormous. Now, I live in New Mexico, within the shadow, as we say, of Los Alamos. And radiation and depleted uranium and the lack of any environmental or pollution policy has been a major problem for residents here. In the old days, they used to take the barrels and anything that was contaminated with radiation from the experimental work being done on the atomic bombs at Los Alamos, and they used to just throw it in the canyons, literally. Now that toxic legacy, they call it legacy waste, is migrating down into Santa Fe, one of our largest cities, watershed. And on certain days, you actually cannot drink from one of their water sources for risk of contamination to citizens. Now, my question is, we have 900 of these Superfund sites, and I presume that we just keep making more of them. What is the likelihood of us taking a realistic approach to dealing with these problems under the incoming administration? Was there any advance in dealing with these problems under the previous administration? What are we looking at in terms of actually addressing the problems that we have already created?
In my view, this is going to be 100% up to civil society to address. So my own experience personally goes back to trying to fight to shut down the United States military base in northern Wisconsin, for example, it had a very faulty environmental impact statement. And we analyzed it, we brought the case to court, and we won in federal district court. And then it took the Navy about 10 minutes to go down to the circuit court in Chicago and get them to vacate that ruling, to lift the injunction that we had succeeded in getting. And all they gave was a two-sentence, basically citing national security and saying that the president wants this facility and it's needed for national security. And so we were defeated. And it was interesting because whichever administration is in power, we're still able to do things at the civil society level so that we continue to fight this. And when we got a big enough coalition, the last significant member of that coalition were the tribes, the 13 bands of the Lake Superior Ojibwa. When they jumped into our struggle, we won. And this was during the first years of the Bush and Cheney regime. So this is a very hostile environment, but we won at that point. So I don't care who the regime is in power, as long as we continue to build bigger coalitions on the ground, we can win. And this is irrespective, in my view, of whoever's at the very top. There are so many layers away from us that we just need to continue to organize.
When we look at the land base that's held by the military globally, it's actually huge. There's an incredible amount of land that's under the control of the military. And we look at Superfund sites, and a lot of the Superfund sites that exist today are ex-military bases. And so when we're dealing with land that's under government control, what are the best ways for us to be able to address the levels of pollution that already exist within our communities? Because when we look at these Superfund sites and the history of contamination within the communities surrounding them, there are already some really terrible impacts being experienced by people, as Rivera was saying. All the people downwind of the nuclear testing, not only here but all over the world, have had severe impacts, and there have been funds set up for claimants that fall short of being able to evaluate the life that is being stolen as a result of this. So we have a lot of work to do, clearly, which I'm sure we're going to continue to talk about going forward. But in regard to what already exists, when we have these Superfund sites and we have all of this contaminated land all over the planet, how do we address those issues and try to clean up some of the lands that are there already that have been causing problems for people that live nearby?
In my view, we've just seen an example of how to do that from Patty Murray and other elected officials, federal elected officials from the state of Washington, who have just written a letter to Trump saying, we want you to put a lot more money into cleaning up the Hanford nuclear reservation, which has been an ongoing decades-old problem. I mean, that's where they made the plutonium for the bomb for Nagasaki. So this is a huge environmental disaster in our region, just like Rivera cited in her region. I mean, this legacy is all over the place. But if you can harness the stated goals of the incoming administration, like Murray and others have done in Washington, and basically say to them, you say that you want to work on providing a lot more domestic employment, you want to fix our infrastructure, this is where you start. This creates a lot of jobs and cleans up. Invest the money in United States workers and get this stuff done. And we can basically harness his rhetoric, I think, to make that case in place after place across the United States. The thing about Trump is he is a raw beginner. We don't know where all of a sudden he's going to open up and say, oh, well, that seems like a good idea. We have no idea at this point. He has proven himself to be completely shallow, garish, just, you know, absolutely off the chain. And yet, at the same time, we don't know what can suddenly connect with him. And he'll have enormous power to say, okay, go work on this. And let's figure out how to commit a lot of money to this place to clean up this mess. But I think rather than, at this point, it's a done deal. He's in. Rather than say, we're going to fight you on every single thing, invite him. Yes, fight him where we need to, but invite him and his machinery of people at the federal level to come and do some of the things that he sort of generalized, said that he was going to do.
You know, one of the things that comes to mind in this is I'm going back to something you said earlier about our choice around conflict management, that we have an enormous military. We keep dumping money into our military, even over the objections of many military officials who object to the use of taxpayer dollars in such an extreme case. But this is lobbied for by the armaments industry, who are the ones who benefit from our bloated military budget. How do we change the attitude and approach towards conflict management that our nation has chosen? What are the alternatives to this hyper-militarized approach to managing our conflicts? And I'm just talking largely in foreign policy and U.S. military arenas. I want to get into the subject of domestic use of militarized police and other types of repression later on in the show. But if we could just look for a moment at what are the alternatives to our choices around our enormous military budget and our approach to foreign policy as a form of, as you so humorously in some ways put it, conflict management.
Yeah, I think that we've got sort of, you know, two ways to look at it. For many years, the Center for Defense Information, which was an organization composed of nothing but high-level military officials, retired, they presented their budget every year as an alternative to the budget presented by either the president or the Pentagon. And on average, they came in at about one-third of the military budget. And the reason for that was that they proposed that we only defend the United States. They believed in military means. They just did not believe in imperialism. They didn't believe in global power projection. They didn't believe in having 800 military bases on the sovereign soil of other people's countries. So what they proposed would be, to me, a way to step back and say, let's fix this international situation and stop doing this bad work internationally. Then, beyond that, once we've achieved that, which would be a remarkable achievement, but it's with all absolutely legitimate military analysis, then look toward the theories of civilian-based defense. I'm looking right now at a brand new book, just came out from Routledge, Security Without Weapons, Rethinking Violence, Nonviolent Action, and Civilian Protection by M.S. Wallace, a brand new book that I ordered it. We just got it in our university library, and I'm looking forward to reading it. But she's a theorist and did a lot of field work with the very forward organizations that are providing nonviolent security, such as Nonviolent Peace Force, but also folding in the theories of civilian-based defense so that we can begin to work our way out of looking at defending everything by the threat or the actual commission of violence. So part of how to think about this, in my view, is to look at those possibilities and then to run a cost-benefit analysis. So when Dr. Patrick Hiller and I did that for a couple United States senators, we presented a cost-benefit analysis around the idea of bombing Syria. And it was very clear from the work that we did, and we made sure everything was, you know, very well cited with the academic literature, et cetera, is that the costs of, and this was in the summer of 2011 or 2012, when Obama wanted to basically bomb Syria. And we said, well, these are the costs that we would project, and these are the benefits. And then we did various conflict management methods. And it was very convincing. And it's like, gee whiz, you know, this is not rocket science. It is complex. It does take some work. But when you look at the, you know, thousands of analysts that the Pentagon employs, it just really seems like if they would throw in a few people from the field of conflict resolution. And, you know, I mean, when the government of Norway has a conflict, they call Johan Galtung. When the government of the United States has a conflict, they call the generals. So, of course, you're going to get different advice. But that advice, the arc of that advice needs to widen. I was very excited when I heard last spring that Erika Chenoweth was summoned to the White House to do a brief debriefing, presumably with President Obama. that gives me hope to think that our researchers on the nonviolent side are finally being at least considered slightly. Now, we don't know what's going to happen. You know, it doesn't look good for the incoming regime, but it still looks good for all of our federal officials who we can get to know on a personal basis and just perform these cost-benefit analyses. The cost of violent conflict are so high. And then when you look at the theories of how do you mediate a conflict, you have to do a lot more creative generation of options. So we would put into our cost-benefit analysis such items as stop defending any borders in the Middle East. In other words, Europe and North America need to shut up about where the borders are in the Middle East. That is their business, not ours. When you introduce those concepts of granting to other people the same amount of sovereignty that we would expect to ourselves, then all of a sudden, the sort of reasons to go to war, the causes belli, go away. When you say, okay, introduce this factor, that we stop all arms transfers to the Middle East and North Africa, then what happens? And start to consider the results of doing things that are outside the current box, because until you say them, they're going to stay outside the box. The more often you say, what about this? The more often that people will start to expand the box.
I think that one of the things that that assumes is that the reasons that we're often given for going to war are accurate when we know that they're not, that a majority of the reasons behind our warring around the world is really about conquest. It's really about securing resources that belong to others. And so, you know, we have to do more than just address our sticking our nose into everybody else's business. We also have to really educate people about the fact that many of the dog and pony shows that we see in the media regarding war are actually manufactured out of whole cloth, that there's very little reality to them. One of the things I want to go to, Tom, is looking at a point of entry for the military. So we have a lot of young people who enter the military in order to avoid poverty or social exclusion or inequality, lessen burdens on their families and communities. And so if we're going to start thinking about how do we start siphoning away some of the power that the military has, certainly that's one piece of it, their ability to be able to recruit from the poorest neighborhoods in the country. So what are some of the viable alternatives that we can provide economically for those who are inclined toward joining the military in order to avoid poverty or to climb out of poverty that will give them the same opportunities? I think we have a responsibility to provide some type of economic alternative to those individuals who are joining the military for economic purposes. What are your ideas about that?
Yeah, I really agree with you, Sherry. When you say, well, the Pentagon's got all the money, so they get to, you know, basically dangle all this in front of young people's faces as those young people graduate from high school and face a future that is, as you accurately say, is like closed off. I mean, there are so many possibilities that could exist that don't exist right now. I mean, I have a friend, I just refer to her as Major Debbie. She was a high-ranking military official, and I was having a coffee with her one day, and I said, you know, I'm sure that most of these young troops, they signed up with a great deal of patriotism, and she scoffed. She said, they want college education. They want three hots and a cot. They want some work right now. It's pretty much exactly what you just said, Sherry. So we have to me, expand rather than say, okay, we're going to try to shut all that down. I don't think that would be met with anybody's approval. Well, it would be met with, you know, my approval and maybe yours and Rivera's, but we're a slender slice of the minority of a public opinion with regard to that. I think instead, if we focused on saying, how can we expand opportunities into other areas, into areas that would serve everybody? So you look at a radical expansion of VISTA, for example, and say, you know, how do we serve our fellow citizens in this country first and radically expand that program, radically expand and renew what used to be in the Great Depression the Civilian Conservation Corps and the Works Project Administration, and say these were not just make work. They really produced a legacy that continues down to us today of really valuable projects. You say you want to rebuild the infrastructure. What a great opportunity. Take young people and give them employment opportunities, give them the opportunity to learn new skills, and you don't have to pay them a lot, especially if they're young single people, and give them the training, and then when they muster out after a certain number of years, they've got an educational benefit and they've got some mustering out bonus pay. This to me would be an outstanding use of tax dollars that would go straight back into not just rebuilding our infrastructure, but skilling up the next generation.
I think this is an idea that has tantalized people for a number of years, and the intriguing concept of we mobilized for World War II, we got out the Rosie the Riveters, we actually pulled ourselves out of a Great Depression, largely in part through first the war and then the economic stimulus of being the one of the only countries standing in terms of the players of World War II. So we didn't just rebuild America, we rebuilt the rest of Europe, which was in ruins. And people don't understand that part of the financial equation. It wasn't that capitalism was so great that it created the boom of the 1950s, enjoyed largely by white people. There were a number of other economic factors playing a significant part in the boom that we saw in this country. Regardless, the idea of this massive mobilization for the climate or for transition to renewable energy or for environmental cleanup or environmental protection or the rebuilding of our environmental and natural resources throughout the country, that has been a tantalizing notion for a long time. Now, one of the things with the current administration is that they're largely stacking the deck full of climate deniers. So I'm not sure that we will see the advancement happening without a massive groundswell on that issue, unless it does, as you said earlier in the show, take the route of creating jobs. Now, one of the things that goes along with the jobs rhetoric is that the jobs that we want are not necessarily the jobs that the politicians who are saying the jobs rhetoric have in mind. Oftentimes, we're looking for that kind of job that takes care of our family and provides health care and doesn't do too much harm to ourselves or our communities at the same time. Whereas, on the other hand, the jobs that people come up with benefit largely the 1%, often are low-wage jobs or have a negative side effect that go along with it. And one of the places we have seen this very clearly is around the expansion of fossil fuels, particularly natural gas and tar sands. Now, as these two industries I'm thinking specifically of have shown their nasty underbelly of health costs to the communities, degradation of the social fabric, and environmental toxicity, there has been more and more resistance to them. And as we are seeing at Standing Rock right now, when the people rise up against the fossil fuel industry, we are seeing a militarized response. So not just in the militarized local police, but also interstate militarized police, and thirdly, sometimes federal agents and actors, or the National Guard, which is also militarized. And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly Nonviolence Minute.
According to H. Patricia Hines' article, The Invisible Casualty of War, Per capita, the military is the most polluting human population, and the system of militarism is the most toxic of human enterprises. Since the origins of recorded history, war chroniclers have told of tactical environmental destruction, polluting water supply, breaching dikes to flood enemy troops in fields, catapulting infected blankets into enemy garrisons, and so on. War breeds environmental destruction, and just as war victims and war tactics have changed in recent times, so has the scale of environmental destruction from war. The casualties of war in the late 20th and early 21st centuries have shifted from combatant soldiers to civilians, with an estimated 9 civilian deaths for every soldier death. The locus of war has moved from battlefields to urban and rural population centers. In 1968, at the height of U.S. chemical warfare in Vietnam with dioxin-contaminated herbicides, an assault on nature so catastrophic that scientists coined a new word for this destruction, ecocide. And likewise, modern war and militarism have a staggering impact on our live environment. Nearly 900 of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's approximately 1,300 Superfund sites are abandoned military bases, facilities, or manufacturing and testing sites that produced conventional weapons and other military-related products and services. According to the 2008-2009 President's Cancer Panel report, this figure does not include the full U.S. military enterprise, namely the Department of Energy's radioactive waste from nuclear weapons and the nearly 1,000 U.S. bases worldwide where our military is not accountable for environmental protection. The military Superfund sites comprise chemical warfare and research facilities, plane, ship, and tank manufacturers and repair facilities, training and maneuvering bases, and abandoned disposal pits. Common contaminants include metal, cleaning solvents, pesticides, machining oils, metalworking fluids, chemical ingredients used in explosives. There are a number of things that are found at these sites that are catastrophically toxic to human beings and catastrophically toxic to our groundwater. Since the United States exploded the first nuclear bomb in New Mexico in 1945, more than 2,000 nuclear weapons have been tested worldwide in multiple environments, above ground, underwater, underground, and in outer space. According to some estimates, the equivalent of more than 29,000 Hiroshima bombs have been tested in the atmosphere, discharging more than 9,000 pounds of plutonium with a half-life of 24,000 years into our environment. The pieces of the federal budget that fund education, environment, energy, social services, housing, and new job creation, taken all together, receive less funding than the defense budget. If, as many contend, the principal threat to world security in the 21st century is environmental degradation through climate change, pollution, soil erosion, habitat loss, and species extinction, then certainly challenging the destruction and damage to the environment and the massive exploitation of oil and metal resources for the military-industrial war machine must become paramount to our work for peace. And now back to our program.
Would you care to comment a little bit about the connection between the rising environmental movement or the protection of water movement or the protection of land and the use of militarized force by the fossil fuel or other destructive companies, such as mining companies, to protect their profits and interests and their ability to extract resources over the objections and demands of a mobilized population?
You know, Sherry can tell me who said this, but, and I'm going to paraphrase, a statement by a Native American: white people don't know this, but the reason that they came here is to learn from us. And I really take that quite seriously, and I think that looking at Standing Rock right now is a perfect example of that. We look for lesson to folks who are rising out of cultures that have been brokenhearted. I am from Minnesota, so of course I spent time in South Dakota and North Dakota and have visited the Rosebud and Pine Ridge reservations. They are historically places of real brokenhearted people. You just don't lose an entire continent and not suffer generations of feeling that way. And yet, having been involved in treaty rights struggles, I watched and learned as the more I participated that not only is everything woven together, not only is everything connected, but the strengths of the tribes, once they are accessed, it's pretty phenomenal. And oftentimes, it takes the courage of a few sort of lone emissaries. Then they can inspire a lot more people to join. And I think that that's what I witnessed in northern Wisconsin in particular. It was a series of lessons to me, as well as a series of inspirations. So I think what we're seeing right now is the ability of non-natives to look to the native communities for examples, leadership, and then how do we act as allies? Because I think that that's exactly what's needed in the coming period. In the first book I wrote back in the year 2000, which was about the ecology of war and peace, I had a section in there called Arms Racism, the military's attack on indigenous lands and life weight. And if you look across this country, it has been astonishing just how racist the policies of basically our way of, quote, defending the United States have redounded upon Native American communities. When those communities rise up, things change. So I was at an Indigenous Environmental Network gathering a few years ago. This one, I think, was in the Black Hills. And I attended a presentation with maps that showed the prevailing winds. And the conclusion of the presenter was the reservations that exist right now could basically be the North American OPEC of wind power. So you send those Native Americans away to lands that are windswept and desolate. And the hope is that you take that knowledge and come back and say, but look what we can construct. You don't need oil pipelines. Look at this wind power potential that exists right now. To me, again, it's about inclusion. It's about coalition. It's about offering true ally support. And that's all in our enlightened self-interest.
Well, Tom, speaking to your quote, I don't know who else said it, but it's something that's been in both of the presentations that you've seen me do, both in California and in Oregon, and it's in my book about the call to have the part of us that has been separated healed, that it was that call that drew people to this land to learn once again about how to connect to the rest of creation. And so if there's somebody else that said it, then we're on the same stream of consciousness, because it's something that I talk about quite a bit. One of the other things I think that's really important is this whole myth of safety that surrounds the military, that we have not only all of this attraction based on economics, but we have this myth of safety that's connected to it. And so we've only had one terrorist attack in this country since Pearl Harbor, and that was in 2001. And those were the first attacks on U.S. soil in 40 years. And they occurred despite all of the super firepower that the U.S. has. Arguably, they occurred because of the power that the U.S. military has in distant countries and that are being used for neo-colonialist purposes. And so, you know, if we look at other places like Australia, for instance, their Department of Defense admits that there are no credible threats of invasion until at least 2030, according to their projections, yet they spend $71 million a day and 45% of all government energy usage, mostly coal-powered. And so when we have this myth that all of this firepower and all of this spending is making us safer, I think that people are willing to turn a blind eye. They're willing to accept it. They're willing to be complicit in the continued degradation and destruction of our planet and of our humanity that's connected to the over-militarization of our societies and the contamination that's caused by all of this energy usage and chemical warfare. So Is there a way for us to start debunking that myth of safety on a broad scale, working together, not only promoting nonviolence, but also demonstrating to people that the threats that we have, the legitimate threats that we face, are significantly less than those that are being reported to us? Is there a way for us to debunk that myth and to overcome all of this wag the dog stuff that's going on out in the world today in order to be able to get people to start challenging in an active way rather than complacently accepting that overinflation of the military budget and the overuse of militarism around the world?
I mean, you raise really outstanding points, Sherry, and the question I would pose to people who say that this is the only way that we can stay safe, and again, going back to what you said about the nominal reasons versus the underlying actual reasons for hot conflict, the claim, for example, for many years that they're attacking us because they don't like our way of life, they don't like how free we are, they're attacking us because we give too many rights to women, because we give too many rights to gay people, then you say, well, why aren't they attacking Canada, for example? Well, it's that if you scrape away those nominal reasons and go to the, as you correctly said earlier, the underlying reasons, one of them is basically the idea that all the global resources really belong to the United States. I was actually on a panel at a local university here in Oregon within the month after 9/11, and I was dumbfounded by the attitudes of my colleagues. These were not people in the peace studies colleague field, but other faculty from other disciplines who would say things like, well, in this era, really the oil of the world belongs to everybody. And I was the only one who was saying, no, actually it belongs to the country who owns that land. That does not, it's not our oil. And confronting that incredibly arrogant entitlement, yeah, I think is really key. I mean, we've got to struggle for the hearts and minds of our students, of our young people, and say, look, these are the values that mean something. We have to stand up for decent values. And it does not include the ownership of kind of everything of value to industrialize society around the world. It just does not. That these resources actually do belong to the people of the country in question. I think this is, you know, this is really basic. It's a basic argument that unfortunately we have to continue to make. And I think that all of these value-based arguments are on the table at all times. And this is, it's unfortunate, it's not fair, but it's reality.
I think there's so much work to be done in debunking the myths around our militarism, in clarifying, as you and Sherry have been saying, the stated reasons for war and militarism and the actual reasons, and for rethinking our almost like programmed at this point into our culture, the imperialism that founded this country and continues to be a major dominating, literally dominating, philosophy within the populace. I think this is a important point for people to work on and not to get complacent about. But despair can be such a setback for people. I know that people felt that after 9/11, that we in the peace movement were massively outgunned by the propaganda machine of those who wished to invade Iraq and Afghanistan. But the reasons to persist are so vitally important. They literally save lives. And at this point in time, the entire future of humanity is on the table due to the environmental connection with war and militarism. So my question for you, Tom, is we've spent the show talking about the intersections and the interconnections between war, militarism, the environment, pollution, climate change. and global resources, things like refugee populations, political and economic and environmental instability throughout the world due to these interconnections. But the one interconnection that I would love to talk about before we get towards the end of the show is, how can the peace activists and environmental activists work better together on our shared issues and concerns and understand the overlapping interconnections between the work that we are currently doing largely in our own arenas?
Yeah, I think we have to expand our coalitional efforts so that, as we learn from the Standing Rock situation, that we better reach out to veterans because they can be the deciding vote. And we better reach out to indigenous activists and they can be the deciding vote. So looking to the intersection of peace, environmental, but bring in other sectors and appeal to their enlightened self-interest and figure out where our shared interests are. Focus on our shared interests. Forget our shared differences. Those are not material, especially in the coming period. In terms of violence and nonviolence, that's pretty much my only like red line. And even that we can work with, in my view, by saying, look, for this campaign, we've got this particular specific goal. We want to clean up Pease Air Force Base. We want to clean up Camp Minden. We want to clean up Wright Pat. We want to clean up the Jefferson Proving Ground. Wherever it is that we're focusing on, be very specific and say, this is a specific goal. This is a specific campaign. For the duration of this campaign, can we all agree that we can act with nonviolence? Once we decide that, I think then the coalition really can go ahead and build to the point of victory. And the idea to me is to focus on all of these individual cases and say, okay, so can we work on Fort Sheridan? Can we work on Kirtland Air Force Base? Can we work on the Honolulu problem with the Navy contaminating water there? And get these localized things, start winning them one by one by one, and do it with increased coalitional building. Focus on building coalitions so that people who weren't talking to each other before are talking to each other now. And at the end of the day, they can say, okay, we achieved this. Now we're going to go back to our separate arenas, but you got our number. Call us next time. We can start to rack up victories at the grassroots level, in my view, that will be a model for us and, most importantly, for our youth.
I think it's really important for us to be setting good examples for our youth in everything that we're doing, especially right now where we see so much of the behavior that's being modeled that incites anger, that incites violence in many instances. I also think that it's really important for us to recognize that our activities, I think it was Rivera who said something about persisting. One of the things that I think is really important for us to recognize right now as we're heading into this new era is that, you know, there's sayings that have become so common that they're cliched at this point in time, but they arose because of simple truths that were attached to them. We know this spiritually. We certainly know this in regard to physics and energetic principles, that whatever we resist persists. And so when we're thinking about how do we want to move forward, do we want to move forward with massive resistance so that we're maintaining the friction that is arising, or do we want to rise up with persistence, continuing to put forth the same ideas that we've been putting forth, but using the mass numbers of people that are rising up with us, as you said, you know, indigenous rights issues, indigenous people can be the deciding vote. Veterans for Peace, you know, retired veterans can be the deciding vote because they took this oath to uphold the Constitution. And when they use that, their position to promote issues that are being misconstrued within the public sphere, which happens all the time. One of the things that concerns me about what's going on right now is that it's largely confrontational and resistance-based. How do we persist in moving forward the things that we most want to see in the world? I'm going to be speaking at this event called Writers Resist on the 15th here in Maine, and I'm going to either make a sign or get a t-shirt made that says Writers Persist, because I think that it's really important for us to make that distinction. Are we standing up and supporting what we most believe in, or are we standing up clearly to point out the water that we've been drowning in? And so as we're moving forward, as we're starting to address some of these issues, as we're addressing the issues of militarism, do we move forward by promoting all the things that we want to have exist in the alternative to that? And do we persist in moving those agendas forward, or do we just resist? What is the correlation in your mind between those two words, persist and resist, as we move forward?
I don't think of it as either or. I think of that as a both and I realize that there are times when there's more focus on one and times when there's more focus on another. This is, of course, the way that Gandhi taught, but it's also last year when Winona LaDuke came to speak to us in Portland, she said kind of the same thing. She had a great slideshow and she showed all of the amazing alternative energy and permaculture that was going on White Earth, which is her reservation. And then she showed a slide of her and a bunch of other people on horses going to confront Keystone in that case. And she said, unfortunately, there are times when we also have to resist these very negative, direct, imminent, existential threats. And so it's like, yeah, it's a good idea to go down to the courthouse and file to run for fire chief. It's also a good idea to just put that fire out if you see it happening. And so, you know, there's constructive programs. So I know for me, when I lived in northern Wisconsin, it was important for me to go off grid, have solar panels. I built a passive heated solar cabin. And when it was 50 degrees below zero, it would at least not be freezing, even without a fire in my cabin. And I think that, you know, those drives toward building the kind of world that we know would obviate any need for any violence at all have to be balanced by the occasional need to resist that violence because it's directly threatening our children, our water, our planet. So it's a wise balance, and I'm not claiming to be the wise old owl who can tell anybody else how that balance should be in their life. But I am convinced that Gandhi was right, that Winona was right, that we do need to have it in balance. And that if we're out of balance, that if the only thing that we do is offer resistance, then I really agree we're headed down into despair for the most part and burnout. And if we can't do anything but resist, then we're not offering an alternative. Because at the end of the day, if you say, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, and this is wrong, it's nothing but a lugubrious litany to people unless you tell them, and here's how we can make it right. Look at what these people did over here. Look at what these other people did over here. They had the same problem, and here's how they fixed it.
I think that's such an encouraging approach to take, and one that has a very good track record of success in terms of helping people change and transform, even within the massive scope of the U.S. military. When we look at militaries around the world that have reined in, de-escalated, changed and transformed their approach, often we see that someone or some ones have persistently gone about showing that there is another way, an alternative way, and that it might work better for security and defense than the strategy that's currently being employed. The same is true for environment, and the same is true for our economy as well. So I like the injunction that you give everyone to consider the balance and where it lies for each person at each moment, and that as the Buddhist scholar and nonviolence trainer Joanna Macy likes to point out, that at different points in our lives, we will be in different proportions of that kind of creating the new or resisting the destruction. and that each part feeds our souls in different ways, protects our communities, and builds the world we want to see in different ways, in different proportions. Tom, we are at the last very few minutes of the show, and I just want to remind the listeners that we are speaking with Tom Hastings, who is the director of Peace Voice. He's a professor of peace and conflict studies at Portland State University, and he's the author of several books, including a book called A New Era of Nonviolence. Tom, do you have any last thoughts to share with the listeners and any ways that they can find out more about your work or perhaps find your books or connect to some of the ideas that you feel are most important for them to connect to?
Well, I think we're all just in it. I really appreciate Sherry's use of the word persistent. We're in it for the long haul, and we have to pace ourselves. We have to really focus on doing positive things, constructive things that really help our hearts. We've seen the more we wage war, the worse our economy is. That old myth that you mentioned about, oh, the economy was saved by World War II, that's hogwash. The human cost, the environmental cost, the economic cost all lead to the question, so how's that violence working out for you? It's not working out for humanity. We need to return to other methods. We need to look forward to other methods, to think outside the box, to be creative. The one thing that gives us hope in our brains, in our human neurobiology, is what we are hardwired for in an illimitable sense, and that is creativity. The human brain alone has enormous, essentially illimitable creativity. All other animals can claim superiority in one sense or another over humans. That's our one strength, and that's our one hope.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's been a pleasure having you on the show with us. And as always, Rivera and I love having conversation with you. And we look forward to having you back again one day.
It would be my pleasure, and I thank you very much.
Thanks this week to our guest, Tom Hastings. And thanks to my amazing co-host, Sherry Mitchell. Our theme song is Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find her great music, including our theme song, at www.dianepatterson.org.
And I'd also like to thank my wonderful co-host, Mr. Vera Sun. It's an honor every week to get on the airwaves and to share this incredible information with you. If you enjoyed this show, you might also enjoy the things that I share on my Facebook page, Sacred Instructions, which can be found on the Love and Revolution webpage and on the podcast. If you feel so inclined, it would make me smile if you went over to the page and gave me a like. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program, and your local radio station can broadcast it. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on Rivera Sun's website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera Sun. Tom Hastings, Sherry Mitchell, and I have just spent the last hour regaling your ears with the many connections that occur between militarism and the environment. But as we all know, this is just the tip of the iceberg of this issue. So listeners, maybe you'll look around side to side and around your community and see where the intersection of militarism and environment affects your life, and find one way to get to work on cleaning that up by the time we talk to you next week.